This is Tax Update for Saturday, February the 11th, 2006. Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of this document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or this document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged without prior permission. This podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters of interest to tax professionals, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners who are subscribers to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. As well, please visit our site and make sure that you get the materials for this podcast. The podcast materials are generally linked to from the show notes that are available on either my website or the Lineberg site's podcast library. And you can find the materials for this podcast will be consist of a PDF file that has a number of source documents tagged on the back, plus has a bit of a discussion that we'll go over today. This week, we'll consider the IRS reconsiders, CRTs, the spousal right of elections. Now, we're entering into tax season now, probably in a bit of a serious way for most of you who are CPAs and in tax preparation business, and who have to deal with the fact that we're in compliance time. But this week, we're going to talk about a planning opportunity, or something that a lot of us have used as a planning opportunity, and we'll do a quick review of charitable remainder trusts, plus discuss the fact that the IRS recently has backed off what was a potential problem for charitable remainder trusts that the IRS discovered last year, came up with a fix, and now has backed off the fix after deciding maybe the cure was worse than the disease. A charitable remainder trust, for those of you who aren't aware of what it is one of the few ways that you can make a gift of a partial interest to a charity and still maintain a charitable deduction. In general, partial interests are not allowed. Section 170 that deals with the deduction for contributions to a charity tells us in F3 that essentially a contribution of a partial interest will only be deductible if made in certain manners. And essentially, Section 170 F3A contains the general rules, and it says in the case of a contribution not made by a transfer in trust of an interest in property, which consists of less than taxpayer's entire interest in the property, a deduction shall be allowed under this section only to the extent the value of the interest contributed would be allowable as a deduction under this section if such interest had been transferred in trust. So basically, we have restrictions here that are going to prevent us unless we meet the trust rules. Now, there are three exceptions that you need to be aware of here that we find in Section 170 F3B. We won't deal with those in any detail in this one, but there are three other exceptions besides the one we're going to talk about today, the trust transfers. The first one will be a contribution for remainder interest in a personal residence or farm under 170 F3BI. Under 2I, a contribution of an undivided portion of the taxpayer's entire interest in the property. That means an undivided interest in real estate, for instance, would work. You give a 50% interest in real estate, undivided interest, or a qualified conservation contribution. Now, that particular one has attracted a lot of attention in the past year and a lot of chance that Congress may make some changes in that area, but that's a whole nother discussion to get into. Now, if you move up just slightly from 170 F3A, you're going to find 170 F2, which tells us about contributions of property placed in trust. And generally, it says, Section 170 F2A, in the case of property transferred in trust, no deduction under this section for the value of a contribution of a remainder interest is going to be granted unless the trust is a CRT or a pooled income fund. A CRT is described in Section 664. A pooled income fund is described in Section 642C5. Now, essentially, we're going to go into this week the definition of what is a CRT, what is a charitable remainder trust. and then look at an issue that the IRS uncovered last year, created their little solution for, and which we're now going to unfix as of a recent IRS notice that tells us we're going to kind of put off the fix for a while. In fact, we're going to be grandfathered in under the, we're just not going to pay attention to this test for a little, for an undeterminate length of time. Under Section 664, there are two types of trusts defined as charitable remainder trusts. There is the charitable remainder annuity trust, which is defined as Section 664(d)(1), and the charitable remainder unit trust defined at 664(d)(2). Now, in general, both types of trust provide that I, as the donor, put a piece of property into the trust. That property, which could be cash, could be securities, could be virtually anything that goes in the trust, but I make a contribution to the trust. The trust then gives me back for a period of years or for my remaining life expectancy, and maybe life expectancy of myself and another party or other parties, an income interest. So I get income for a certain period of time or for a time period governed by the life of the people involved, the beneficiaries involved, that comes back to me each year. When the trust terminates, either because the term of years has expired or because the last beneficiary has died, the remaining balance in the trust corpus, moves over to the charity, who receives the property at that point as a contribution. That is why we call this a charitable remainder trust. The charity gets the remainder after the income interest has been paid out over the years. Now, there are, as we say, two types of trusts here. The first trust is a charitable remainder annuity trust. In an annuity trust, you basically receive a fixed payout per year that's stated at the beginning of the trust. So I put my money into the trust, I will receive $6,000 per year for the next 10 years. At the end of the 10 years, the value of the property will pass on to the charity. The charitable remainder unit trust is computed somewhat differently. In the charitable remainder unit trust, the trust can pay out a percentage of its value each year to the beneficiary. So at the end of each year, I take a look at what's the current fair market value of the property in the trust. I pay the income beneficiary a percentage, say 6% of the value of the property in the trust, and then we go on rolling forward. Now, a unit trust can provide that the payout will be limited to the income of the trust for any particular year. So I can provide that although the unit trust says I should receive 7% of the value of the trust this year, if the trust didn't earn 7% of the fair value, my distribution will be limited to the income. The trust may or may not contain a makeup provision that would allow me in future years, if the trust earned in excess of the 7%, me to make up any skipped distributions I had received in previous years. But essentially, I have got an income interest that I receive as the beneficiary, and the balance at my death or the balance at the end of the term that was set up when we started this trust goes to the charity. Now, these trusts offer some unique advantages. The key advantage really are twofold. Number one, we get, as the donor, a charitable contribution for the present value of that remainder interest. So this is computed using tables, basically tabularly computed. There is a method of computations that we use, and we run it through a bunch of numbers, and usually we turn it over to the computer to take care of this computation. Although I suppose if you really want to, you can go through all the manual computations, but usually we throw it into the computer. We have the computations come back, which tells us the percentage of what we put in that we get as a current deduction. That is treated as a charitable contribution on Schedule A. Then, secondly, basically the trust itself is exempt from income tax. That is the trust. We know under normal rules, if a trust has income and does not distribute that income to the beneficiaries, or is not required to distribute or does not distribute that income to the beneficiaries, that the trust itself pays a rather nasty income tax on that income. But a charitable remainder trust, as long as it remains qualified as a charitable remainder trust, is exempt from the income tax. What is not exempt are the distributions that come out of the trust. The beneficiary will be taxed, and that taxation goes on a pool concept. In essence, we create four pools of assets from which the distribution will be deemed to come from. And those pools go in order. We add them up, we keep a running total, and we have to totally exhaust a higher pool before we get to go into the next pool. And those pools are, in general, ordinary income recognized by the trust in current years or prior years. That's the top pool. Capital gains for the current or prior years, the next pool. All other income, basically tax-exempt interest, for instance, that is the third pool. The fourth pool is trust corpus. So those are our four levels. So basically, we take a look and we distribute based on that. Now remember, the trust itself is exempt from tax. What that means is it serves as a very good vehicle to convert a low basis, high value asset that is not generating current income, or for which we would like to diversify our portfolio. Maybe it's generating income, but we don't want all of our eggs in one basket. We'd prefer to have it diversified out a bit. It allows you to take that asset, sell the asset, not pay tax currently on the gain, and reinvest the proceeds, and then let the proceeds provide for the income stream that will be paid to the beneficiary. That is why a highly appreciated position is great to go in there. Usually, that's why we do not see these funded with cash. Rather, basically, property that would generate a gain tends to go into the charitable remainder trust. Now, you need to be careful. There are rules you've got to watch for, especially if you have a piece of property where you have one that would be difficult to sell. One that is a trade or business, you need to be very, very careful how you structure and to make sure that you're not doing an assignment of income problem when you get the assets into the trust. But that's a whole nother discussion we're not going to get into at this point. Let us presume for the moment we are simply talking about some highly appreciated stock. Somebody had Microsoft shares from day one of the company and now has them sitting there. Let's say Mr. Gates wishes to do this. If Mr. Gates wants to do this, he puts his Microsoft shares into the charitable remainder trust. The charitable remainder trust sells the shares. Those shares, which would generate a huge gain, generate a gain which goes into the capital gain pool in the charitable remainder trust, but is not subject to current tax. Rather, only the percentage of income that comes out, the percentage distribution, only that will carry out the capital gain. And it would carry out the capital gain, presuming that there was no other ordinary income that would be in the pool ahead of it that we would have, or we would at least exhaust that pool, and then we'd be able to pull some capital gain out. Now, generally, a CRT makes sense for a client who meets four criteria. First, the client has substantial assets that are highly appreciated. Substantial, I note, because charitable remainder trusts have relatively high cost of setup and maintenance. We have to get the trust document drafted. We also have to file trust returns every year for this charitable remainder trust. We must do the accounting. In a unit trust, we have to value the trust every year in order to compute the distributions. We have to make sure those distributions get made. We have to make sure the trust is operated in accordance with its terms. All of those issues mean that there is both a significant cost to get into the trust. We need to draft the document. We need to be able to get everything done. We usually have a lot of planning. We have to value the charitable contribution. So generally, you have an attorney and a tax professional, CPA, working with the client in this structure, both of whom are going to charge the client. Then every year, that trust needs the return prepared, so we're going to trigger a compliance cost every year. As well, since unit trusts tend to be used quite often, we have the valuation issue that also comes into the accounting. So the accounting work for the trust every year, the accounting and tax compliance work, is not insignificant. And it's also one of those things, it doesn't really get more difficult, or the additional cost is not linear. That is, there is a very high fixed component to the cost of running any charitable remainder trust. But it's really not all that much more difficult to manage a charitable remainder trust, do the accounting for a charitable remainder trust, if it has $1,000 in assets or it has $1 billion in assets. Essentially, therefore, the more substantial the assets, the lower the administrative costs are going to be as a percentage of what goes in there. That strongly suggests that it's nice to have a lot of assets to do this. You're wanting to do it with a large piece of asset. As well, highly appreciated helps. As we note, the asset is highly appreciated. We are going to lose a percentage of the asset to taxes if we try to convert it over. Therefore, the highly appreciated allows us to sell the asset and shelter for a time the gain from taxation. Second thing that needs to be present for the client for this to make sense. The client generally has charitable intent. Like it or not, we are making a charitable contribution. And anti-abuse provisions that have gone into the law in recent years mean that that contribution will be at least somewhat significant. In essence, we are generally not going to be able to structure one that allows us to bail virtually everything out of the charitable remainder trust. That was a structure that was used a number of years ago. The IRS came down on it. Congress then legislatively came down on the structure. So essentially, we have to leave minimums in there. So it will help if the client has charitable intent. Second reason it helps. As noted, there are administrative costs, there are fees, there are going to be bother involved in handling this. A client who did not have charitable intent is likely to get very, very frustrated with this and is likely not to be terribly happy with the structure. So a client who does have true charitable intent is useful here. Now, as noted when we discussed the substantial assets, I would note as an aside that if you have a client who doesn't have substantial enough assets, you might want to look at things like charitable gift annuities, the other option for doing a similar thing. Your flexibility goes down, but they are much cheaper and simpler to implement because generally the charity is taking care of the issue. Now, third thing to qualify a client for a charitable remainder trust. The client wants to convert the appreciated assets into a different form, either to diversify the assets or to be able to generate income from the assets. So the client wants a stream of income, and the client wants to be able to access that stream of income. Generally, that's a useful thing to be true in a charitable remainder trust. If the client truly never wants to see the income and truly never wants to access it, it may make a lot more sense to make a straight charitable contribution. It will certainly be much less expensive in terms of legal and accounting fees to do that. But if the client wants the stream of income and then says, after I pass away or after 20 years, the charity can have it, then this structure makes sense. Fourth, the client must be one who does not have a low tolerance for complexity in tax matters or who has a high reluctance to pay for professional fees involved in tax matters. If the client has resistance to fees, you are going to have a client that will not like the structure. Secondly, if the client is a keep it simple, stupid client, meaning don't complicate matters, I don't like things that are too complicated, they probably are not going to like this structure either. So no matter how wonderful it may be for them from a tax standpoint, it's probably not the right structure for the client. Now, all of that said, we've used charitable remainder trusts in the right circumstances a number of times. But last year, the IRS discovered an issue with the charitable remainder trust that threatened charitable remainder trusts in a number of states. what we're going to find is one of the requirements to qualify as a CRT is that no amount other than that income distribution may go to anyone but a charity that is described in Section 170C. That prohibition is found in Sections 664D1B for annuity trust and 664D2B for unit trust. There cannot be the possibility that any portion of the trust assets can go anywhere but to pay the income interest that is given or to a charity. If your trust provides that at your death, the shares go to the charity unless my nephew Sid wants 10%, it's not a unit trust, it's not a charitable remainder trust, and it's not going to qualify for these purposes, and the trust will be fully subject to regular income taxation. Last year, the IRS released Revenue Procedure 2005-24, discovering a problem that arguably had existed since day one of CRTs, but which the IRS just discovered last year. It finally occurred to them this could be a problem. In certain states, a surviving spouse has the right on the death of their spouse to claim an elective share of assets that are transferred on death. An elective share is essentially a provision in the law that prevented you from making your spouse destitute by essentially disinheriting the spouse. The law essentially provides that that spouse has a right to step in and take a percentage of the assets regardless of what your documents say, if they elect to do, or if they elect against the will, elect against the transfers that you have set up. Now, this is meant to serve a public policy perspective to keep spouses from being made destitute, especially keep spouses from being made destitute when they're not aware of it or when they've been coerced. So the point of this was, you know, a very good public policy point. This is mainly found in common law states, community property states, just because of the structure of a community property transaction works under different rules in general. In general, this is not an issue there because we have everything in community. But in this state, and community property states don't generally have elective share structures. Now, the IRS looked at that and decided the mere existence of the theoretical right that your spouse might claim an elective share at your death, even if that right is not actually executed by your spouse at your death, serves to invalidate the trust from the moment that theoretical right comes into existence. That is, since your spouse has a right to elect against you, essentially the minute you got married, or if you were already married when you created the charitable remainder trust, the instant the trust was created. As well, if you moved into a state that had an elective share provision that would become applicable to your trust, then the day you moved into the state with the elective share provision, your CRT was invalidated. An invalid CRT is subject to those old nasty rates on the income tax, the income tax we talked about, those high marginal rates. Not a good result. Now, the IRS admitted they hadn't really been asserting this earlier. In fact, I didn't even mention it earlier. So in the revenue procedure, the IRS did allow the trust form prior to June 28th of 2005 would not be penalized by this rule so long as the spouse did not actually claim an elective share. That's in Section 2.01 of Revenue Procedure 2005-24. For trusts created after that date, the IRS said, well, we're not going to ignore the problem anymore because now we realize it's there, and the way we look at it, we don't have an option to ignore it. At least at that time, they felt they didn't. So the IRS said, for those trusts formed after that date, the existence would invalidate the trust, the existence of the right would invalidate the trust unless a waiver valid under the applicable state law was executed by that spouse within certain time frames. Generally, the waiver had to be executed within 6 months of the due date of the Form 5227 for this charitable remainder trust, including the extensions that were actually granted to file that return, in which the latter of the following four things occurred. The date the trust was created. The grantor marries. The grantor becomes domiciled or resident in a jurisdiction where there exists a right of election that could be satisfied from assets of the trust, or the effective date of a state law that creates the right of election. So basically, if there is an event that suddenly brings this into the possibility, if the grantor died today, that there would be an election against the trust, you have to get the spousal waiver in place at that time, within 6 months of the due date of the 5227. Now, it's important to note, taxpayer may start out living in a state that doesn't have a right of election, but then moving into a state with it later, so they can trigger it backdoor. Now, a number of complaints emerged about this ruling. First, many people pointed out that some people are going to be trapped by this out of ignorance. Simply because they moved to a state with an elective share, they're not aware the problem exists, and perhaps their advisor, if they keep the same advisor in the old home state that didn't have one, because they always like to work with that guy back home, they may not realize there's a problem in the new state, and the trust may be invalidated by accident. Second, remember, the right of election is a major public policy point. That's why it's in the law. It may not be possible under the state law in question, for the spouse to execute a waiver of his or her rights to elect against the trust, because the state law and the state decisions may decide that it would be too easy for a nasty spouse to coerce the survivor into signing such waivers, so they may just invalidate those as a matter of course. Therefore stating that in some states it might be impossible to form a valid charitable remainder trust unless you stay unmarried. Kind of gives a new term to the term marriage penalty, a new view on the way marriage penalties work. Well, the IRS had considered those complaints. Now, they'd been considering them for a while because they issued this revenue ruling, this revenue procedure last April. Remember, on June 28th, June 29th, the trust drafted had to meet these rules. So we had a June 29th trust. We needed to be in this. The IRS just recently came down with notice 2006-15 that says, we have reconsidered. And the IRS announced they will indefinitely extend the June 28, 2005 grandfather date until further notice. The IRS goes on in this notice to indicate they are reconsidering the entire approach to this provision. They're going to reconsider any elections and all the whole issue of how to deal with this. Now, the IRS goes on to note that they're going to apply the same rule they were going to apply to pre-June 28th trust. If a spouse actually elects against the CRT, that will make it not a qualified CRT. But if the spouse does not elect against the trust, the mere fact that he or she could have will not invalidate the trust for now. Now, what does this mean about the future? Well, I think there are a few possible things that are going to happen in the future to straighten this out. First, it's possible the IRS might decide to ask Congress to legislatively fix this. In essence, modify 664 to provide some mechanism for dealing with a spousal right of election. Secondly, the IRS might take another shot at this one. They might come up with some new mechanism that they will count to allow a trust to qualify if the spouse executes certain documents. Could be a possibility. Again, it's one more thing that's on the table. Or, finally, the IRS could just leave the whole thing in limbo. The IRS probably feels that they can't really state that the law says we can, the law says this doesn't count because the IRS believes maybe correctly, that it does count, because obviously assets could pass to somebody other than the charity. But they've said we're considering it. This leaves it in limbo, sitting around where we can ignore it for now. And if the IRS never gets around to fixing it, then it stays ignored, at least until they someday decide to pick up the issue again. This is the kind of limbo we've been put into on self-employment tax for limited liability companies, where the IRS pulled the proposed regulations under pressure from Congress, or at least stopped doing anything with them, and so we've been sitting with that one for quite a while. We may sit in limbo on this one for a while. But it is an interesting concept. Now, that said, obviously the original revenue procedure had a bit of a chilling effect on CRTs the last half of last year. It seemed a bit risky to put one together, even if your state did not have a right of election, because the client might go somewhere else, and the client therefore might foul it up in the future. Now we're back to perhaps where CRTs may make sense, though probably we still have to warn our clients that this issue is out there, the IRS might do something about it, and there may be developments they need to keep up with this. But that said, it is important to remember the charitable remainder trust can be a useful tool in the right situation. And if you haven't worked with them before, they're an interesting concept to consider. Note, they do have their complexities. For instance, one very, very big negative for a charitable remainder trust is that a charitable remainder trust cannot have unrelated business income in a year. If it has unrelated business income, then it becomes fully subject to income taxes. This is a nasty provision that exists for CRTs, and that's important because Section 664C provides that it's exempt from taxes so long as it has no UBIT. If you are working with charitable remainder trusts, it is very, very, very important that all parties, the client, the client's investment advisors, be aware that we have to avoid UBIT-generating investments. If the investment potentially could generate unrelated business income, it probably shouldn't be in the CRT. You need to be careful in this because many times you will see UBIT thrown off on certain partnership investments. So if the investment advisor has this wonderful idea for throwing the client into this K-1 partnership, you may have to object and say, you know, unless that is absolutely certain never to throw off UBIT, that's probably not the best investment for a charitable remainder trust. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, February the 11th, 2006. I'll remind you again that we are coming up on Valentine's Day, so hopefully during tax season you haven't forgotten that one coming up. And if you're listening to this on the 15th, well, and you find out you have forgotten it, well, that probably wasn't a good thing. Tax Update is, again, meant for those who are able to do their own independent tax research, and you should confirm everything we've discussed here before taking any actions for a client. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, February the 11th, 2006.